Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio, which is my favorite edition because it's the Friday edition.
Somehow this doesn't sound sincere.
Why?
I don't know. Just the tone of your voice, maybe.
I'm just very happy to...
Oh, you're just super happy.
Say that out. I'm here on a Friday. Also glad to be here at the station right now. I look forward to doing these shows very much. And in fact, more often than not, I come away learning something myself. Obviously, there's a lot of prep that goes into it. But what ends up happening is I think when you find yourself like pacing yourself through the show, aspects of it begin to come out. And I feel like I learned something as well, as hopefully some of the listeners are. So let's get right into it. Now, right now, with our series, How Music Changed, which we've been doing on Friday since the beginning of time, it feels now. We'll probably be doing till the end of time. With us covering 250 of the most important musical events of the past century, taking a deep look at some of them. The current topic is early piano, from blues to boogie-woogie to big band. This is part 15 out of 250, and this is actually the fourth show dedicated to that part, if you could follow all that. Now, this being the fourth part, I'm going to be jumping around a lot. But for the first three shows, we were more or less chronological, starting with really the beginning of piano history, you know, basically with ragtime, et cetera, in America.
Then you went parallel.
A little bit parallel, right. We had gotten to Fats Waller, got his name right this time, moved from Fats to Art Tatum, which was sort of a chronological line. But now in this show, we're going to continue with more on Art Tatum today, but then we're going to go into the Wayback Machine and sort of start again. I mean, I'll tell you what this is about. When I was planning this specific series, this early piano series, it seemed like it was going to be nearly impossible for me to cover the history of piano from this era with any degree of chronological accuracy. The reason was like fairly simple. The piano players back then tended to move in at least two very distinct directions simultaneously. There was the stride players, who we have been covering so far.
Right.
And then there were like the boogie players. And if I were to cover them both at the same time in chronological order, you'd have a really hard time trying to discern the relationship from one player to the next or from one style to the next.
Yeah, so it just makes more sense.
Right. So, I mean, that's why I just decided I'd cover the stride players. Let's do what stride did. Now, when I say stride, stride were the players that pretty much stemmed from the ragtime thing and then moved very much in the direction of jazz, with popular music being their main idiom. They would, obviously, if you listen to Fats Waller and Art Tatum, a lot of their work came right out of the pop songbook. Or they wrote songs for the pop songbook, in Fats Waller's case. But very much influenced what jazz would eventually develop into and become on that side of it. Until it eventually hits a wall with Art Tatum. Because once Art Tatum came along, there was, as we said last week, you could just simply go no further than him. So it ended up sort of being... The stride playing ended up sort of like dying out after Art Tatum because there was just nobody left who could do it as well. The second school of piano, though, that was happening at around that same time, really early on, was much simpler than anything Art Tatum would have ever done and much more direct in their approach because they were basing their styles mostly on the blues and really the fundamental rhythms of dance music made it very simple. So this group became known as the Boogie Woogie Players. So in their time, they weren't as famous as, say, Fats Waller or Art Tatum, so we won't cover on specific artists quite as much in that regard. But it needs to be covered to some extent because ultimately it was their influence that ended up being more influential in the long run and insidious, eventually overwhelming in terms of like what it eventually did for popular music. So today, like I said, we're going to cover a little bit of both. We'll start by finishing our focus on the stride players, and then we'll bounce back a little bit to the early 20s. That being said, we were talking a lot about Art Tatum last week. And
you still got something else to say about him,
well,
I'm guessing.
One of the things that I had brought up was that one of his major influences was Earl Hines. And I had neglected to play a piano piece by Earl Hines. And I think it makes sense that I should. Earl Hines is not only incredibly famous as we had covered him as a sideman for Louis Armstrong, but he was an excellent piano player in his own right. Eventually, a very important band leader who in his later age did an awful lot for the bebop players. People like Dizzy Gillespie actually came up in a band with that was being led by Earl Hines. So Earl Hines is going to come up in a number of our shows of How Music Changed in different aspects of his career because he was a very versatile man. In this instance, though, I want to basically cover his piano work and the style that was so unique and distinctive of his own that had such a huge influence on Art Tatum. Few people had this light, airy touch as though they were floating above the piano as much as a guy like Earl Hines did. And he played with time a lot, which made it a lot of fun to hear what he was doing. It made him very unpredictable, which is, I'm sure has a lot to do with why Art Tatum loved him so much. So with that in mind, here is a piano track featuring Earl Hines, a song called Glad Ragdoll. Once you get familiar with Earl Hines' style of playing, he's one of those guys that you could probably pick out from hundreds of tracks because he's got a very unique touch and a way of, like I said, kind of like, I don't want to say flails around the keyboard, but he'll suddenly, he does very interesting and unique.
He's got a signature sound, though.
Yeah, very signature, like flourishes that he'll throw in that are suddenly very light and airy. Like I said, it's almost like he's floating above the keys, and then he's got a very strong sense of rhythm anyway. It's like you feel that he's floating away from it, and then boom, he's right back on it in a very strong way. Excellent sense of rhythm, and another reason I'm sure Art Tatum loved them. Speaking of Art Tatum, though, there's something that I need to clarify. Now, last week when I had come in to do the program, I had a playlist, as I always have playlists for my show. Somehow last week, the playlist got mixed up a little bit from the actual CD itself, and the tracks were actually misarranged
yes.
a little bit. So I was having some trouble finding the exact song that I meant to play. And at one point, I got to give you a lot of credit, Heidi. I remember that I had played Fats Waller's version of Ain't Misbehavin', and I wanted to play it back-to-back with the Art Tatum version. And that's when I knew that something was wrong, because the track that came up was Art Tatum playing a blues that was structured like Ain't Misbehavin', but it wasn't that song. I played a different song. And you even said when it came back on, boy, it changed it so much, I don't even recognize it. You were right. And it was right around that time when I began to scramble to figure out how to fix it. We were okay from that point on. But I would feel remiss if I didn't correct my mistake now by playing Art Tatum's version of Ain't Misbehaving to more or less show you the growth or the leaps and bounds and the amount of just dexterity and I guess the impossible that he brought to playing the piano. All very visible in this version of Ain't Misbehaving by Art Tatum. Was enough to make grown men weep. Grown, talented, famous piano playing men would weep listening to Art Tatum. And the thing about it is,
or end their careers.
Right. And as we had said, the thing that made it so painful was that he made it look so easy and effortless. He didn't even look like he was trying when he was doing all that stuff. Really, I guess the truth is that he probably wasn't really all that much, because it came so naturally to him, because he developed his talent by essentially constantly playing. He was the type of guy that ended up, he loved his piano more than he loved women. Even, you know, he certainly loved his booze too, according to the stories. But he's had more than enough marital problems, because he would be the type of guy that would go out to play piano every day of his life if he could. And he would stay out until the sun came up playing the piano every day. He was just that addicted to it.
Well, when the piano talked back, it only said what he wanted to hear.
Right. Well put. I'm sure this had a lot to do with one of the reasons he loved it so much. Exactly. So he was the type of guy that, in a sense, you know, his life was his practice, and practicing was his life, because his life was a performance. So he just never really let up. And he just, you know, went on that way as much as he possibly could. Now, besides, you know, obviously covering other people's songs, most of what he did was covering other people's songs, of course, but he had this really great ability to basically shift styles from what was just pop songs to doing things that were like a little bit more experimental, great with moody pieces as well. And this is one of those that left a huge impression on me when I heard it for the very first time by Art Tatum. It's a track called Taboo. can't even talk. Really. I mean, that right there, that really is the last word. Like I said, you know, that is, that's your dead end. That song right there, Taboo. You could talk, you know, people always talk about the greatest soloists. You know, who's, you know, in my generation, it was always, who was the best lead guitar player of all time. You know, you hear names like Eric gets kicked around, Eric Clapton, you know, Jimi Hendrix. And it's almost laughable. And I no offense to either of those fantastic players, please. You know, God knows that I'm a huge Jimi Hendrix fan. But even Louis Armstrong, about who I'm probably one of the biggest fans on the planet Earth, there's just something about what Art Tatum does in his, as a solo player of his instrument, that makes him just unreachable in terms of what anybody else could even imagine doing. and he does it on a level that's so consistent that it just renders you speechless. Really, if you were going to have a throwdown with anybody about name the track that's got maybe the best solo performance by anybody in the history of music, I would say pick that song, and I don't think you could lose. I just think that that's it. Right there is maybe some of the best, not just piano playing, solo instrument playing by any human being in the history of recorded music. And it wasn't just acknowledged by jazz players. It was acknowledged by classical players, people who were trained for their entire life to read music, European-style music, that heard this and recognized this and had these opinions of Art Tatum. They called him God for a reason. And that track is it. Incredible. The song is called Taboo. We are looking at the history of early jazz piano and how it developed. And it's kind of funny when you think that in the hands of a genius like Art Tatum, it would actually begin to stop developing. But
he scared the competition off.
It more or less forced everything to go in a different direction. It just did, because if you were going to say, well, I'm going to follow and, you know, what Art Tatum did and take it to the next level, good luck, because you're not going to do it on this planet Earth. It's just not going to happen, you know? It's just impossible. But before we do move on from Art, though, I want to play one more track of his. I guess it's appropriate for the title in particular, song by Art Tatum. This is called My Last Affair.
Thank you.
a beautiful, more mellow song, I suppose, by Art Tatum. Nothing conventional about it, but maybe more conventional in terms of it being a pop song and being something which was so that other people could imagine perhaps how to approach a song like that, you know? And it also basically shows how he had developed in terms of like moving from the early parts of Stride to what jazz was sort of becoming, which brings me to the next piano player who I want to cover. There are very few, like I said, because of Art Tatum, very little about Stride managed to grow and move into conventional jazz beyond, say, 1940. One of the Stride players, though, that did a significant job of doing that, and who we, when we get around to covering him, we will be covering him for many, many, many shows, is Mr. Duke Ellington. Now, Duke was one of those guys that would be up in Harlem with these Stride players at the rent parties, dealing with all the competition and everything else. And nobody was going to say that Duke was up there with, say, James P. Johnson or Fats Waller, or certainly not Art Tatum, in terms of what he could do on a piano. But he was still able to transfix the entire room as well as anybody, in some ways better than anybody, because of a lot of reasons. First of all, he had an incredible sense of class about him, and he also had an authority about him, personality-wise. He just had a way of basically looking like he was in charge, because he really had brilliant ideas as an arranger and as a writer. So he was one of the few people that actually took Stride from its quote-unquote strident style of what it was and turned it into something which was much more fluid. And because of the fluidity that he brought to it, it allowed the music to grow and change, which is why, to this day, Duke Ellington is now a household name. And
he embodied the word grace, I think.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, his body of work is immense. And we know it now because he actually brought us from point A to point, who knows, KLM. You know, he moved things along significantly.
He covered a couple of points.
Yes, exactly. So let's hear a piano version, though, of Duke playing stuff, which might be reminiscent of what he might have been doing up in Harlem around the same time as these other guys. This is a song by Duke called Black Beauty.
Thank you. Obviously, a track that has much more to do with Duke's orchestra than his piano playing per se, but I chose it mostly because of the piano intro that he does to bring the song in, and also because of the title, Echoes of Harlem, which does bring us right back to where all of this really was developing, and it sets up the mood for that, for the atmosphere of the times and of the space, of the place itself, which is pretty cool. Now, Duke being one of those people that was able to move stride from where it was, say, I could basically in its specific time and place, to being something which was much more modernistic and helped the music to develop, to be very influential. The other artist, unfortunately not nearly as much of a household name, and it's kind of amazing to think that, and that is the piano player by the name of Mary Lou Williams. Mary Lou Williams has been called perhaps the greatest female musician in the history of jazz music. And you can understand why if you had known her entire history. She has done enough pretty much achieved more than most people would achieve in four generations. She squeezed this all into her one life. She was one of those players who basically self-taught, learned how to play completely by ear, became one of really the only, as I said, the stride pianist, though, who actually was able to modernize her style. She early in her career, she started writing arrangements for bands and orchestras, got quite famous doing so. In fact, even people like Benny Goodman, Jelly Roll Morton even complimented her. And Jelly Roll Morton complimented nobody.
Nobody.
for him to say, you know, kind words about her, that really says something. And then her reputation going on, not only as an excellent piano player, but as an arranger, where she had actually written parts for people like Benny Goodman, Earl Hines, even Tommy Dorsey's orchestra, doing all that.
Wow.
She her style went from early Stride. She became so developed in the way that she modernized her sound that she was eventually actually playing with people like Thelonious Monk, Bud Powell, Dizzy Gillespie. So this is all the same, you know, one woman.
They're innovators.
Exactly.
Right there with them.
Able to bring herself forward very much into the next generation and become a part of it while her style changed. Even as late as 1978, Benny Goodman asked her to appear as a star for his 40th anniversary concert at Carnegie Hall. And she passed away at the age of 71, but she basically had all of this behind her, including, by the way, she also taught music at Duke University in the latter part of her life. So very busy woman, amazingly talented woman. You can only imagine what she had to put up with as far as sexism and things like that. Being just a woman, a black woman in pop music, I guess in jazz music. Of course, you know, being black wasn't so much the issue at this point because almost all these talented players are. Really, just about all of these piano players that we're covering so far have been. The only difference is Mary Lou Williams was also a woman. So you could just imagine what she was up against. But check it out. I mean, I don't know why she did not get the recognition as far as being a household name, because she very much deserves it. Here's one of her tracks. It's called Fifth Dimension. In so many ways, it actually is like the perfect transition song for me now, because I will be covering Mary Lou Williams much more as we moved into the middle period of jazz, the classic era of jazz. And we discussed the piano players of that era, people like Bud Powell and such. She will be a very, very much featured artist in that section. Here, I just want to basically discuss her as a transitionary character in terms of what was happening, not only from Stride, but that song in particular, I think, is a great transition one, because I want to go back to the earlier style again, back to the 1920s with the other boogie-woogie thing that was also developing as well. And that song is a good way to do it because you can hear a lot of blues in what's coming out of Mary Lou Williams' style there on that track. Now, a lot of the boogie-woogie stuff, for the most part, was actually developing in Chicago more than in New York. Again, maybe because there was like a much more of a blues thing that was happening in Chicago compared to New York. I would imagine that has a lot to do with it. And yet the players who were doing it really never got particularly famous. You probably are not going to know many of the names of these guys. I'll play a track by each of them, perhaps, to give you an idea. Mostly because they really weren't recorded very often. The first piano player that I want to cover is actually from one recording from 1927. His name is Meade Lux Lewis. Basically, he had one solo record that he put out in 1927. One. It was called Honky Tonk Train Blues. Came out and then eventually just slipped into obscurity. It wasn't until like 1935 when John Hammond, the entrepreneur, the music entrepreneur, mm-hmm. actually heard that record. You know, seven years later, went out to find Meade Lux Lewis and found him washing cars for a living in Chicago. That's what he was doing. He says, Hammond actually picked him up and brought him to New York City so that he could perform at Carnegie Hall for the Spirituals to Swing concert in 1938 that helped to disseminate jazz and the history of jazz. Mm-hmm. So one of the people who was there representing the earliest roots of it was Meade Lux Lewis, starting this very early style of piano, which would eventually be called boogie woogie. Here is Honky Tonk Train Blues. If you want to talk about roots music now, yes, that's much more simplistic, of course, than what we would have been playing by Art Tatum or even by Fats Waller mm-hmm. or even Duke Ellington, for that matter. But as far as influence goes, you want to talk about like the early roots of rock and roll? What might have been the first rock and roll record? You might have just heard it in a lot of ways. You know, how much boogie ended up being in rock and roll?
That's right.
It really is incredible. That's exactly, if you go back far enough, you pretty much end up hitting
that. Well, definitely. All the terminology that was used to describe this music carried on into the whole rock and roll.
Wow, thing, it's amazing you said that, because that's exactly what I was just going to talk about. That was brilliant. I'm so glad you brought that up, because the next person I want to play, his name is Pine Top Smith. He was another one of the guys actually from Chicago.
Great name.
Pine Tops, yeah. Clarence Pine Top Smith. Now, he was also from Chicago. Now, they were doing the same thing, sort of like what was happening in Harlem. They were having rent parties, all-night jam sessions and everything else, but where the Harlem side of things would take on, let's say, a popular music and a jazz sort of a tone about it. Mm-hmm. What was happening in Chicago was much more blues oriented, much more party, you know, driving rhythm, very, you know, eventually what would be like a rock and roll feel to it. And this is a big part of what Pine Top was doing. Now, again, he was another one of these guys who recorded very, very few songs. But his biggest hit came out on the Vocalion label in 1928, and it was called Pine Top's Boogie Woogie. Just like you said, Heidi, the terminology and stuff. Well, mm-hmm. This is credited as being the very first time the term was ever utilized on a record, when Pine Top pretty much invokes the audience to stop and then, okay, now boogie woogie. Never happened before. This track. Here's Pine Top Smith.
Now when I say hold yourself, I want all of you to get ready to stop. And when I say stop, don't move. And when I say get it, I want all of y'all to do a boogie woogie. Hold it now. Stop. Boogie woogie. That's what I'm talking about. Get ready to stop. When I say stop, don't move a peg. When I say get it, everybody mess around. Hold yourself now. Stop. Mess around. That's what I'm talking about. Girl, you standing there with the red dress on. Back right up here at this piano where Mr. Pine Top is. That's right, face the audience. Now when I tell you to hold yourself, you get ready to stop. You hear? And when I say stop, don't you move a peg. And when I say get it, I want you to shake that thing. Yourself now. Stop. Shake that thing. That's what I'm talking about. Now I'm gonna pick this piano.
This also is another way for me to get back to one of the very first subjects that I brought up when we got onto this topic about dumbing things up, I was saying. You know, you basically,
yeah, I don't get that term, but okay. I'm going to roll with it.
Well, it applies here in terms of like the ultimate, in terms of like what I was ultimately getting at. Here, they simplify the style even more to be really very rudimentary, simple, really, especially mm-hmm. compared to the New York style of piano that was going on. But it's this dumbing up style, the simplification of it, as you will, making it a little bit easier to play and understand, that ended up helping to make it become more influential so that more people would be able to play it. It would popularize it, and mm-hmm. it would lead to things like R&B and rock and roll developing out of it.
I see.
That's really exactly – that's like pretty much exactly what I was trying to work toward, but I couldn't do it in one show. It took four shows for me to get to that point. Now, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, now that track by Pine Top Smith, you can pretty much, it's got rock and roll written all over it, doesn't it? If nothing else, it's certainly a fun party track.
Yeah, you know, for sure.
You wish you could have been there in the room for that when that was happening, because it just seems like so much fun. And obviously, it had a huge influence on the big band era, because here from the war years, the mid-40s, which is to say 20 years after it was originally recorded by Pine Top, you can hear somebody like Tommy Smith lifting the riff pretty much wholesale verbatim and putting out his own version of it, just simply calling his Boogie Woogie. Now, of course, there's a lot more that I want to cover. I just wanted to give you a taste of hearing that, how Tommy Dorsey would actually pick up on that riff from that song.
Right.
And utilize it. Now, we had heard from Mead Lux Lewis and Pine Top so far, both artists who I may want to cover a little bit more next week if it's at all possible. But there's a third player from Chicago. His name was Albert Ammons, who I also feel compelled to cover. Now, the real reason I want to cover Albert Ammons at the same time, not only because he was a slightly younger player who was often duetting with Mead Lux Lewis. They would get gigs together, the four of them, sometimes on one piano. And they'd play four-hand piano together.
Oh my goodness.
On their gigs.
That must have been something to see.
It was very, for Boogie Woogie, it was actually not an uncommon thing to do. And again, it adds to the party atmosphere and everybody would have a load of fun with it. But the other aspect of it is that Albert Ammons was also learning an awful lot from Pine Top, mm-hmm. as it turns out. Because not only were they all in Chicago, all three of them lived in the exact same apartment house.
Oh, wow.
So you want to talk about the roots of Boogie Woogie, find that building.
Afternoons were like school.
Just imagine, you got Pine Top, Albert Ammons, and Mead Lux Lewis all pretty much going home to the same place after the gig. It's hard to believe, actually.
It was easier to afford a piano.
Right, right. Ammons met Mead Lux Lewis because they were both driving taxicabs for Chicago's Silver Taxi Cab Company. So they were just discussing the fact that they both enjoyed playing, piano, and they ended up getting gigs together. And like I said, that's they would have ended up ultimately playing, what you could say, four-hand Boogie Woogie. Mm-hmm. Albert Ammons actually was also very interesting. I believe that he was the very first artist to ever record on the Blue Note record label.
Wow.
So how about that?
That's a claim to fame.
Yeah. So all that being said, he also had a son who was, Gene Ammons, tenor saxophone player Gene Ammons was his son, a pretty famous bop player. So he knew how to pass the music around, this guy. So let's play some of Albert Ammons' version of the Boogie Woogie. This is his song called Boogie Woogie Stomp. Thank you. once again, another hour has slipped by so quickly. But we did cover a lot of ground in today's program from a history perspective. We got to play Earl Hines, a few tracks by Art Tatum, a little bit of Duke Ellington, Mary Lou Williams. And from there, we were able to move on to some of the most elemental players of the boogie-woogie style, Mead Lux Lewis, Pine Top Smith, and there, Albert Ammons. Now, we'll be back with a little bit more boogie-woogie next week, and the development of boogie-woogie is a lot of the people that I can still cover. You're talking about cool names, Heidi. How about Cow-Cow Davenport? Or Pete Johnson, Jimmy Yancey. There's a lot more that we can do next week as we perhaps get to wrap up this series of programs. But I want to leave you with one song by one of the people we already covered that I think might help to convey how all this boogie-woogie and stride and everything eventually rolled into a ball that even set up the styles that would eventually be, as I said, R&B and rock and roll. Played by none other than Mr. Duke Ellington. Here he is performing Rockin' in Rhythm. Take care, everybody, and I hope you can join us again next week.
Bye.
Thank you.